Begin with the questions from yesterday. One question is, can you tell me your story about decision to be a monk rather than ordinary man? first evening I did speak about this a little bit, and to recap, well, let me go back a bit and tell you that as a child, I suffered from asthma a lot, so I missed a lot of school, which in England, for a young boy, is not such a bad thing. I enjoyed being alone off school and used to read a lot. And so I was probably more thoughtful, introspective than most boys of my age. As I also mentioned, I didn't have any sense of connection or faith or confidence in teachings of Christianity. They didn't make sense to me at all, and rejected them from very early age. So in my teens, the way into Dhamma, if you like, was really an intense interest in life, the world, my mind, happiness, suffering, what's a good way to live, what's the best way to live your life, what kind of goals should you have in life. Because it seemed to me everyone was just on a very narrow and limited path. You know, you do O levels so you can get A level, you do A levels so you can go to university, you can get a degree, you gotta get a job, you get a family, you get a house, and so on and so forth. And I thought, to me, you know, I was thinking there must be something more to life than that. I found that really sort of depressing prospect, just of working and making money and just living the normal life. So I wanted to know, why is there so much suffering in the world? Why is there so much injustice in the world? Why is there so much violence and cruelty in the world? Does it have to be this way? why is it that everyone in the world wants to be happy, but there seem to be very few people who have much idea about how to go about it? And looking at people who are supposed to be really smart and with degrees and even doctorates, don't find them particularly wise people, or very hard to find anybody I could see. And I thought, yeah, I'd like to be like them when I get older. So I had so many questions about life and the world and so on, that I started to read a lot of books of psychology and philosophy and things like this. And my first observation of reading works of Western philosophy was that there was a huge gap between the life of the philosopher and their philosophy. You should read the philosophy, it sounds really cool. You know, they say, oh, that's very profound. And then research their biography and find they're not very nice people at all. And for me, that a philosopher should be able to express his teachings in his life. If he doesn't, it's just a fake. It's just thinking. It's superficial and more or less a waste of time. So eventually, I came across teachings of the Buddha, and I was immediately impressed, and it seemed to me just obvious and common sense and straightforward, and no although I had quite a developed critical faculty, ability to analyze and take things apart, I couldn't find anything to criticize or to object to in Buddhist teaching. So this was a turning point for me in my life. And so after I finished my A-levels, then I worked in the building site, in the warehouse, and saved some money. Because I'd had a principle since I was very young, maybe 13, that I wouldn't ever take any money from my parents, that I'd be self-sufficient. And so, working a paper round and on a gas station, petrol station, things like that when I was a teenager. And so then I set off for India and interested in just general life experience, but also specifically in Buddhism and Eastern religion. And after many adventures, I returned to England after almost 2 years, by which time, it's clear to me I didn't want to go to university. I didn't see any point in it. All I was really interested was Buddhism. But I didn't quite know how to go about living a life in the world and devoting myself to Buddhism. And I enrolled on a Buddhist meditation retreat, which was led by an English Vipassana teacher who had been a monk in Thailand for 6-7 years. And in his evening talks, he would often refer to his experience as a monk in the forest and caves of Thailand. And that was a revelation. Although I'd been all as far as India, I'd never been able to make it to Thailand. And to know it would be possible to live my whole life as a monk, it's not just going on a course for a few weeks and finding myself back at square one, but being able to give many years or my whole life to this, that was just an obvious choice for me. It wasn't like a big decision, it was just obvious. So I came out to Thailand before that I heard that there were some disciples of Ajahn Chah living in London who were looking for a place to build a forest monastery in England. And I went and lived with that community under Ajahn Sumedho for a few months, the Pansar of 1978. And then following that in November of 1978, and I came to Thailand and went to Ubon and became disciple of Ajahn Chah. So that's more or less what led up to becoming a monk. What kind of happiness we found when we've been bored. A monk is very restricted in what he can tell lay people about his own practice and attainments. But I would say that right from the beginning, there are so many things that made me happy, right from, just the first year or more, sort of struggling to adapt and to the climate and to the lifestyle and so on. And in the late 70s, early 80s, conditions in Northeast Thailand were very primitive, very difficult physically. And, while I've been a monk, I think I've had every kind of fever going, malaria and typhus and typhoid and the other one, Rok Chi Nu, all kinds of things. But for me, what I loved, and you know, I've loved and still love to this day, is you know the fact that you can be living in a community of, like, say, 50, maybe 50, 60 young men. You know, like young men. A lot of these the Thai monks are like farm boys and quite tough characters, and yet to feel completely safe. And that sense of brotherhood and kindness and gentleness and manners amongst young men in their 20s and 30s. I can't think of any other environment in which you would find anything like that. I mean, the standard of conduct and behavior and the refinement of it is unique. So just to be living in any kind of community and have that sense of safety and being valued and respected and being and having people around you that you look up to, and you looking at people who've been doing this for years and you find them inspiring and you think you'd like to be like them, you know, that's just such a wonderful thing as a monk to be able to experience. And then the other thing, that you all share the same goals. You're all practicing for the same thing. And there's nobody's trying to compete against anybody or take advantage of each other. And there's not that somebody wants this, somebody wants that, and different values and expectations, but all, you know, all in harmony. So there's a harmony of conduct and a harmony of aspiration or view or understanding of life. So even before you get onto all the happiness that arises from leading a good life and from keeping precepts and from practicing meditation and more increasingly refined kinds of happiness, even the basic level of living in a virtuous community is already a wonderful thing. The I think to give some idea, then observe. You know, it's very important to observe in your mind the way in which defilements make you unhappy, when you feel really happy, not just sort of you know, excited or stimulated, but that real sense of inner pure kind of happiness is dependent on the absence of defilement, then you can begin to appreciate the kind of happiness that arises in the life of a long-term meditator or a monk or a nun. So you see how constantly your own greed and discontent and jealousy and anger and so on, these are the things that prevent you from being happy in life more than anything else. And the only, I think, intelligent way to seek for happiness in life, it must involve, on one level or another, taking on these defilements and seeking to overcome them. Because whatever worldly accomplishments you have, if it's not accompanied by, balanced by this inner spiritual endeavor, it'll always be hollow. You know, you'll always be having the feeling, oh, I thought it would be more than this. You know, you look at some kind of standard of living or having some kind of possession or being well-known, famous even in society, all these things, and they seem so fantastic. And then again, people who do get these things, there's this sense, I thought it would be more than this. You know, this isn't still quite it. You know, there's still something missing. And this is the essence of the life of an unenlightened person. You know, there's still something not quite right. There's still something missing. And that can only be overcome by, as I say, by working to develop mindfulness, wisdom, compassion, all these virtues, and to deal with defilements. next question. What is merit or bun? And how can attending a retreat program like this contribute some merit to our loving parents? The classic definition of merit found in the scriptures is in Thai, kriyang chambra sandan. So it's something which purifies or uplifts you, something which we could say increases the quality of your life. So give you an example in the realm of giving. You say, so giving is merit, you know, is merit involved in giving. Why? In what way? Well, the attachment to material possessions and the worry about them and the craving for them and all the selfishness that comes up in our relation to material world is something that really makes the mind kind of shallow and narrow and immature. So training a mind to find the joy in giving and sharing some part of your wealth and some part of your possession is directly opposing that selfish, stingy attitude. So it's undermining it. It's working to just to very gently work away at those negative mental states that arise as someone with possessions, in the life of someone with possessions. But when we give, you know, there are different kinds of giving. You know, there's giving with strings attached and giving without strings attached. So if you give something because you want something from them, so you might want some material reward, you know, what's in it for me? I'll give you this, but, you know, I'm expecting a favor here, or that's not very meritorious. There's not much bun there. Why? Because look at your mind. There's not that sense of giving and relinquishing, but it's a bargain. It's a business deal. You know, I'm giving you this because I want this. And what you want might be something material, or it might be I'm giving you this so you'll like me, or so you'll respect me, or so you'll know who I am. So whenever you have some thought of gaining something in return, you can notice that the mental state is very different from when you just give because you see someone suffering and you want to help to alleviate that suffering, or you see something doing something really good in their life or in society and you want to support that. In a traditional case, seeing monks are leading a good life and doing something really worthwhile and useful for society, and you're inspired with the teachings of the Buddha, you want to support them, so you make offering to the monastic order, to the Sangha, or to charities, charitable foundations, or and it's that sense of and notice if you have no expectation of any kind of recognition at all, then it's a very special kind of feeling. You know, it's just done completely out of sense of generosity. And look, I've got enough. You can make really good use of this. Please take it. And that's the sense of we have wealth, we have possessions in order to be of benefit and to create happiness. And if sometimes we've got more than we need, or we can share, then we can create happiness and benefits on a wider scale. It's a wonderful thing. So if now we were to look back on, you know, two occasions in our life where we've given something, one in which we gave without any expectation of reward, just because we said it was a really good thing to do and we were inspired to do that. And another occasion where we've given expecting something in return. Now, if you look, try and look at the feeling in your mind when you remember that pure giving and that giving with an expectation, and the feeling is very different. You know, you in the sort of business deal kind of giving, you just feel kind of chay-chay, it's nothing. But the moment you recollect some act of true kindness that you performed in the past, even if it's a year or 5 years ago or 10 years ago, you immediately feel good. You immediately feel happy and proud in a good way. And this is how you can see what bun is. You know, there's bun is a source of real happiness because once you've performed a good action or a kind action, whenever you remember it afterwards, you always feel good. And it's a kind of a treasure in your heart. When you're down and when you're depressed and things are not going very well, rather than seeking some distraction, some enjoyment, some drug or something, you're bringing to mind the good things that you've done in your life, just immediately raises your sense of self respect and happiness. So any action of body, speech, and mind which reduces the amount of greed, hatred, and delusion in the mind, something which comes from wisdom, compassion, kindness, that is merit. And you know, there are a lot of wrong, mistaken teachings about merit out there these days, and one to be particularly wary of is this idea of merit can be measured. You know, that you give money, if you give 1,000 baht, you get more merit than if you give 100 baht, or if you give 10,000, you get more than 1,000, and that the more money you give, the more merit you get. That's a very childish and non-Buddhist idea of what merit should be, or what merit is, rather. Merit is coming from the purity of heart and that sense of renunciation, kindness, the wish to help and to support and to do something good, and the wisdom in choosing that which is offered, and also the also dependent on those who receive the offering. Because if you make offerings to someone who uses them in an unskillful, improper way, then that's not a very good outcome either. I forgot just now, as I didn't finish answering the previous question, do I get bored? Actually, I struggle to remember ever being bored. I tell you, if I get bored, is if I'm in a or something like boredom. If I'm in a city or something, and someone plays music, I find music really boring. But I find silence very very pleasurable. I don't know how people can sit and listen to music for more than 5 minutes at a time. I mean, what is boredom? I mean, boredom, you look at boredom. What conditions boredom? One boredom is if you're really attached to excitement. The more you like to be excited, the more boredom you're going to have in your life. Because boredom means this isn't exciting enough. It should be more exciting. So the more that you look for happiness and excitement, you know, the moment the intensity of excitement just reduces a little bit, then you're going to feel, you know, bored. You know, and this is one of the faults or the problems about sensual pleasures. So, you know, things you can see and hear and touch and smell, is it suffers from the law of diminishing returns, which means. Let's say, for instance, a pill you take a pill and then you get a certain kind of high from a pill. But after a while, one pill's not enough anymore, and you have to increase to two, and two's not enough, and to get the same pleasure as you got from one, not to get twice the pleasure. And you have to get more input to get the same result. And this is true in any kind of sensual pleasure, and in realms of sex and violence and all these things. There's this same kind of law there that you, like the, in movies and stuff, you know, the amount of gore and bloodshed and incredible kind of spattering of blood everywhere, and has to be more and more and more and more. So, you know, otherwise you just feel, you know, it's boring. Seen all this before, you know. This is, they've been doing this for years. So there's this natural tendency in art, even modern art and everything, to be more outrageous and more. It just be so that something is different from something you've seen before, and the fact that it can excite you, it is a sign of quality. You know, it's sort of something which really makes you stop. Wow, you've never seen that before. You know, that's considered to be sort of like a really good thing. So it's a cycle. You know, the excitement and boredom cycle, and they're not two completely different things. They're one and the same thing. They're two faces of the same thing. Okay. How can attending a retreat program like this contribute some merit to our loving parents? Well, first of all, I'm speaking to someone, you know, growing up in England, you know, I know even the concept of bun kun in English culture is not there. I mean, you know, there's families where everyone loves each other and children appreciate what their parents do for them, of course, but it's a term as a kind of an underlying foundation of the culture. It's not there, and the number of people that I knew, you know, or I know in England, who, you know, only see their parents like just at Christmas or like once a year or absolute minimum. You know, how little can I see my mother and father without being criticized, you know, or basically to keep things okay. Very, very common in the West. And the amount of aversion to parents and the amount of blaming of parents, it's a really unfortunate, unpleasant thing in Western society, I find. So I, you know, was really in going to India and being far away from my family and meditating that I began to appreciate all the things that I'd received from my father and mother. For instance, I now, of course, as a monk, you know, so many rules I have to keep, and even before that, I found traveling alone where there's no structure at all, where I could do anything. Nobody knew who I was. You know, I could get up anytime, go to sleep anytime, eat anything I wanted, do anything I wanted within reason. Where I had to create my own structures. I found I was quite self-disciplined. You know, I could create boundaries for myself and standards for myself, or I had limited funds, so I determined that while I was in India, I only used $1 a day. I had to cover everything: travel, accommodation, food, everything. So even though a dollar those days is, of course, you know, whatever buying power, much more than a dollar these days, it was still really very very little money. And sometimes I'd just go without eating something, or I'd just sleep rough, rather than go over my limit. And I found I could do things like that. And it was when I was meditating that I realized just my capacity to do something like that was very much thanks to my father. And it was something that when I was a teenager, I used to just find so frustrating. And so, you know, my father was like, no is no. You know, and he said, "But look," and you get all these kind of reasons and hit porn, and he said no. And you could, you know, you could shout, or you could be cunning, and you could, you know, whatever kind of strategy, you know, no was no. And whereas I hated that when I was a teenager, as soon as I left home and I had to look after myself, I thought, wow, that's one of the best things that I, you know, I can see in myself, ability to say no is no. And I thought, where does that come? It comes from my dad, you know. And so in meditation, so you're coming in, you're looking at yourself in a lot more kind of objective way, at your strong points and your weak points and things that, yeah. And you say, yeah, actually, that comes from my mom, that comes from my dad. And so I think that kind of increased awareness of, you know, all that we have received from our parents comes when you're willing just to spend some time with yourself in a meditation retreat, where you're not just hooked into all the social media and all the things you've got to do and places you have to be and so on. And you can just stop and just be with yourself for a little bit. And there's a lot of things that are just below the surface that just come up. And you think, yeah, I never really thought about that before. I never really appreciated that before. So also the, you know, the practice of Dhamma and say the making of merit, you know, is the learning ways to reduce the amount of defilements in your mind and to increase the amount of wholesome Dhammas in your mind. So basically you're becoming, you know, a better person through meditation. And that's, you know, going to have a very positive effect, I would hope, on your family life and your relations with your parents. So, you know, they would certainly appreciate that. And then, you know, we have these practices and ceremonies of sharing of merit. Of course, there are these philosophical questions, or how, to what extent can you actually give merit or share merit and so on. But I think it's just, apart from anything else, just a beautiful way of using your mind. Whenever you do something, you get some kind of wholesome, positive happiness. You think of sharing the benefits of that with others, particularly those who are your loved ones, your benefactors, and so on. Okay, I'm going to pass on from that one. I can't continue with something.
Could you please explain why is it important for us to try to achieve stream entry in this lifetime? Is it hard to achieve for lay people?
Yes. Okay, well, stream entry, for those of you not familiar with this term, is a technical term. It's the English translation of we call sotapattipon, banlopinpat sotaban. So the Buddha explained enlightenment as it being there are four levels. So there's stream entry, and then there's what we call a once returner, or a sakitagami, and a non-returner, anagami, and then the highest level is arahant. In fact, it's not that it's like a step ladder that you go 1, 2, 3, 4. Somebody might go, just jump up to the fourth level, or go to the third and then the fourth. So it doesn't mean you go one by one necessarily. But the first level is very interesting for a number of reasons. This level called stream entry, or the stream entry, is the first level of enlightenment, and it is the key moment, because in a whole of our history in samsara, all these many births, because someone who realizes this level can no longer be reborn in a lower realm. This is a kind of law of nature. So someone who's reached this level, never again will I ever have to be born in a hell realm or as a bread or a pea or an animal or any... there's only two possibilities, like as a human or as a deva. And not only that, but that the realization of nibbana, like full arahantship, is inevitable in not more than seven lives. So you've put a time limit on your wandering over all these millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of lives. Now, although the higher levels, the anagami and arahant, it's very, very difficult as a lay Buddhist to realize that. I mean, all these levels are difficult. But since the Buddhist time, there have been laymen, laywomen, people leading ordinary family lives, keeping five precepts, working in the world, who have realized stream entry. And this is why many teachers, including myself, say if you're looking for an ultimate spiritual goal as a layperson, as a Buddhist layperson, then stream entry is a very good goal to aspire to, because it's something that has been proved to be practical, realizable as a layperson. It's not something that you have to become a monk or a nun before you can aspire to or expect or hope to realize. The realization of stream entry is dependent on the abandonment or letting go of certain key defilements. And the most important of which is the view, the attitude of the body and the mind as being self or belonging to self. And that view cannot be overturned or destroyed through samadhi, only through wisdom or vipassana, which sees the impermanence, the ultimate unsatisfactoriness or dukkha, and the anatta of all aspects of the body and mind. And now, simultaneously with the letting go of that view through vipassana, then one also loses any doubt in the Buddha's teaching, because you've verified it now through your own experience. And thirdly, like attachment, all kinds of techniques and practices and views falls away. So this is the realization of stream entry. I have this question is in Thai. Mae duk luk baap rup lao. Yeah, I mean, it depends on the definition of duk as well, doesn't it? You know, if you recall in my explanation of kamma, that the key, the crucial factor is intention. So, say if the mother's intention is good, then it would not be a bad karma, because a bad karma has to have an unwholesome intention behind it. But that, whether or not something is bab is only one consideration. Because when mother, father, or anyone is trying to teach someone or trying to change someone's behavior, then we need wisdom. So sometimes, in some particular cases, speaking a little bit strongly might be just the right thing that's needed. But otherwise, other times it might not be. So the Buddha is saying we have to be very thoughtful in choosing the right time and place to talk about difficult things. If we speak about something that's very important and we have good reasons on our side, but we talk about them in the wrong time, at the wrong time, in the wrong place, then things might get worse rather than better. And skill in the way we speak to each other and the communication skills, you know, this is so important to develop. These don't just arise naturally. It's not like even if you meditate, it doesn't necessarily mean you'll be a good communicator. There are particular skills that need to be developed, wisdom. And the five factors of what we call good speech are: one, you speak things that are true. Don't lie, don't exaggerate, don't change things. Speak things which are not only true but are useful. Speak at the right time and place. And speak making sure that your intention is good. You have metta and goodwill towards the person. You're not trying to have some kind of victory over them and prove that you're better than they are. They don't. You're right. They're wrong, etc. And lastly, to be polite. The whole area of manners is a really culturally it's an interesting one. You see, like I take my country, like where I was born, at least England. Before, you know, English people have this reputation for really good manners, okay? And it's like pudi ankrit, okay? Okay, some of you may have been to really posh schools, you know, where they are, people are very well-mannered, but generally in the society it's not really the case in these days. And one of the reasons is that manners, I think, became seen as part of the class system in England. And it's all part of the way that wealthy people keep the poor people down. And you should keep everything very well mannered, or what good manners are the sign that you're better than people that don't have good manners and so on. So there was a kind of rebellion against manners, and it was considered like hypocritical and false and superficial, always to be very polite. And there's this emphasis on just saying what you mean, and so being direct and being. So there's a cultural sort of sea change, a whole different style of relating came about. I think the word hypocrisy is a very interesting word. Now, how would you translate hypocrisy into Thai? To say someone's a hypocrite, how would you say that in Thai? It's difficult, isn't it? And it, it's not. I don't think it's quite the same. I think that that's somewhat similar. But I think the point that I would make is that. Like people who come to monasteries, like Westerners who come to monastery, you know, sometimes they say, I shouldn't have to bow to someone I don't respect, you know. It wouldn't be true. I would be pretending to respect that person, for instance. Whereas, as I understand it, you know, our idea is that there are certain forms and conventions that guide social life. And that we don't make any assumptions about relative levels of people through that behavior. So, with bowing, for instance, you know, women get very upset. You know, this says in the Vinaya that a nun, a bhikkhuni, who's been ordained for 100, who's 100 years old, would have to bow to a monk who's only been ordained for one day. Oh, that's that's so sexist and misogynist, and that's not fair on women, and so on. But if you look at it in the larger context, it's also the case of the layman of 100 years who might be a stream enterer, would bow to a bhikkhuni of one day. It's not a gender thing. It's a convention laid down by the Buddha for showing respect according to seniority. And it's not considered to be about who you are. So in the Buddhist time, you had the Sangha was a kind of revolutionary institution, because in the caste system, you know, there's even when I was in India, this is only less than 40 years ago, and maybe it's still the case these days. I was invited to stay in the house of a Brahmin, and I remember we were walking through this village, and he was telling me that, you see that man over there, you know, he's an untouchable, and if his shadow should touch my body, I would have to do all these sort of ceremony, purification ceremonies. You know, there's that much kind of attachment to this idea of caste, and not just a physical contact, just a shadow would be enough to defile the Brahmin's purity. So you had this case in the Sangha, where there were Brahmins and Kshatriya and Sudras and Poka everyone, all in the same group. And then they would pay respects according to their seniority. So if you had an untouchable, someone who'd been an untouchable, been a street cleaner, and then you had, you know, one of the Buddha's relatives who was from the royal family, he would bow to the monk who was a street sweeper, because he'd ordained what just a day before or even a few hours before. So it's a structure for overcoming this attachment to who I am and my background and my family and my social status. It's not a personal thing. It's not saying anything about who I am, who you are, or what men are and what women are. And this is very difficult for people from the West to understand, that we adapt our behavior according to social milieu. And the fact that you wire somebody, you wire some politician, doesn't mean you think they're, you know, a really honest or wonderful person, but that's what you do in that situation to maintain the social harmony. I can't remember what I was talking about now. manners. So I was talking about good manners. So do please care for these magic words. Thai's got two magic words that English doesn't have, counterpart to, and that's krap and kap. These are wonderful words, you know, and make sure you don't throw those away. You know, if you've been around people from other countries, other cultures, it's very easy to do that. But these words, I think, they add a certain quality and beauty to human relations, and prevent this real aggression and nastiness from arising. Just a very simple point of mindfulness. Okay, I'm going over time here. I have a close friend who always gets upset, worried, angry, anxious about everything, underlined. Very easily. She is very demanding in consolation and consultation, and always blames how she acts on family dysfunction. Although I see that she has all the love and support she needs. I believe that she's a very good person by heart, her problems controlling her thoughts and fears. I love her very much, but it's been very tiring. Can you recommend some dhamma I could pass on to her to help? Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, if it's really at a certain level, you know, sometimes somebody needs therapy and counseling. Seriously, a good therapist, and there are like Buddhist therapists now, and even in Bangkok, is just someone who's like a good friend, is someone who knows how to listen when you talk and can point out, you know, when you're contradicting yourself and when you're being silly. But it's someone who's completely out of your whole milieu, your family and friends, and someone who you have trust is objective and is giving you the truth. So if someone is really so caught up in their own view of things and can't see things from any other way, then I think therapy can sometimes be a good option. I as a Buddhist monk, I think the ideal thing is practice, meditation, going to monastery or going on a meditation retreat, and learning how to meditate and learning how to see thoughts and worries as passing mental states rather than who we are. But that's a long-term project as well, and it's not an easy thing to do. And ideally, I would suggest both of those things. But the ability just to stand back from all the things that are going on in your mind and seeing them as just noise, that's the skill that's needed. But exactly how to encourage someone to take that on is something else. But if someone really starts to suffer from this, and really, you see, before anyone will change, they have to acknowledge that they have a problem. And for many people, it's really difficult one before they accept that, yeah, they do have a problem that needs dealing with. So that's the first thing, to see that all this upset, worry, anger, anxiety is not necessary. It's not something that's happening to you. It's something that you're doing. You are doing this, and you can stop doing it. You know, it's not that I'm angry because of that person, this person. I'm anxious because this might happen and that might happen. I'm really upset at what he did and what she did. Those are only triggers, or only things that can encourage you to. It's like if you have gloves. Let's say you have gloves and there are all these kind of germs. Whatever germs there are, you're protected. But if you take off the gloves and you just got exposed, that germ can cause an illness, and this germ is because you don't know how to look after yourself. You don't know how to look after your mind. So that's really what's needed. Okay. I would like to hear your view on purpose of life. What purpose was one born for? Are purpose of life different from person to person? Well, I think my answer to this would be, it's important for everyone to consider this and to make this a question in their life, to make this a priority, What kind of goals do I have in my life? And recognize goals of being successful in your career, or making money, or having a family, or whatever. These are completely reasonable, legitimate goals. Nothing wrong with them. But you also, I would suggest, need some spiritual goal as well. And so what would that be? That's something for each person to really consider, and what kind of priority you give it. And how important you consider it to be. I've made various points already that any truly fulfilling life demands a training and an education of how we act, how we speak, how we think, how an education of our emotions. And that without that, we're unlikely to find any happiness in whatever way of life we choose. Yeah. You still here? Everyone here? Can you hear me? What is your view on supernatural stuff? Ghost, sorcery, exorcism, etc. There's a lot of experiences and realms of being which are not accessible to most people. And I think the question here, or important question, is not so much what are these things, how many, what are they like, and so on, but the important thing is, what is the correct relationship to them? So how do you feel about these things? Do they cause you to suffer or not? So we're talking about ghosts. Now, and the question is, have you ever suffered through the actions of a ghost? Probably not. But have you ever suffered through fear of ghosts? Well, yes. So, and let's just take this one at a time. The real problem is fear of ghosts rather than ghosts themselves. Okay? So, if we're right here, here and now, with our real life, ghosts are not a real major issue in our life, I think. But for many people, fear of ghosts is. So, what do you do about fear of ghosts? If we talk about, are there such a thing as ghosts, and I heard this story and that story, and it's really sanuk, it's like good fun. Or some people might get really frightened. But it's just gossip and chatter and so on. The question is, we are human beings subject to fear of things we don't understand, things we can't see, and things that we fear might possibly hurt us. So how do we deal with that? When you get really scared of something, whatever it is, what do you do? When you're really scared, how does it feel? What does fear feel like? Now, what does it feel like? Where do you feel fear in your body? You don't know. So, if you feel fear, come to your body, come to body sensation. Really observe the experience of fear, rather than allow your mind to wander off into speculation and worries about the thing that might be out there. So we can deal with the present problem rather than some imaginary problem. So as far as ghosts, sayasad, all these things, these things are out there, but the question is how to relate to them in the wisest and best possible way. This is a question about different religions. Can different religions coexist? Some believe in different religions can be contradictory. For instance, one of Islamic teachings states if you do not believe in Islamic God, you'll be in hell after death. And Christianity says you only believe You have to believe in God, you go to heaven. Christianity, you die, and then you either go to heaven or hell. And Buddhism, you die, you're in heaven or hell, you're reborn. Well, I mean, there are all these different religions in the world. My critique, if you like, or my analysis of the belief system religions like Christianity and Islam is that they are naturally divisive because they're based upon certain unique beliefs. And so you must always have us, we who believe, and all those that don't believe. And then you have a problem, well, how do you relate to them? You know, what's the problem? What's the right way? So, you know, if you think that the only way that you're ever going to go to heaven is you've got to believe in Jesus, and there are all these millions and millions and millions of people that don't believe in Jesus, what do you do? If you don't do anything, then, you know, you're just allowing them to drop into hell. And so, you know, you get missionaries and both ethical and unethical efforts to convert people. And Islam's the same. You know, Islam's right, everyone else is wrong. And everyone else is going to hell, and we're going to heaven, and we're the chosen ones. All these religions, they're always going to have friction with other religions because they're based upon a belief in things that are not experienced and not experienceable. Now, in Buddhism, you say that there can be rebirth in heaven realm or hell realm, but it's based upon how you live your life, not on what you believe in. So if you're someone who is honest and kind and generous and compassionate, so on, whether you're a Muslim or a Christian or a Hindu, it doesn't really matter. What matters is how you live your life and the way you treat your fellow human being. So we could say, for that reason, Buddhism is like universal religion, because it's taking universal human qualities as the key determinant of rebirth rather than some belief. Nevertheless, I think it is possible for religions to live together if there's some mutual respect. And in Buddhism, we make a distinction between knowing something and believing something. It's obvious, isn't it, that human beings are capable of believing 100% in things that are not true. At very least, if the Muslims believe you can only go to heaven if you're a Muslim, and Christians believe you can only go to heaven if you're a Christian, then either all the Muslims are right and all the Christians are wrong, or all the Christians are right and all the Muslims are wrong, or else they're both wrong. There's like three options, aren't there? So in every one, there are people who have incredibly strong faith who are wrong. It can't be any other way. So the fact that and this is something that people who have strong faith, they overlook. They always say, because I have this incredible faith, you know, I believe so much, it must be true. Well, how do you know it's true? Well, I wouldn't feel this way if it wasn't true. So it's like circular reasoning, you know. It's true because I believe it, and I believe it because it's true. So I think the way towards more harmony of religion is to look, belief is belief. You know, you're free to believe anything you want, but don't say that that's knowing. You may believe that Jesus died to save you, purify your sins, but you don't know that. It's a belief, isn't it? You may believe that Muhammad is the only prophet of God, but you don't know that. It's a belief taken from your book. So, Buddhist way of saying, let's be a little bit more humble here. Recognize that belief is just belief, you know. People like to believe in things. It makes them feel safe, but it's in no way an indication that what you believe in is true. You know, I believed in Santa Claus for a number of years. I really believed. Okay, so we've gone over time, but for the last 10 minutes, I invite you all to close your eyes and just have a short 10-minute meditation before lunchtime.